This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, interesting report of the Commonwealth Fund this week. The nonpartisan health industry think tank has concluded that people with mental illness do better when they have a medical home where they're more likely to receive comprehensive and coordinated care.
Well, I think that's something that we would say we've known from many years of experience, Mark. Behavioral health issues are often so hard to identify and even harder to treat in a fragmented health system. And with one in five Americans experiencing some kind of diagnosable mental health issue within a given year, and that doesn't include developmental delays or substance abuse, that is just a huge need, and it underlies so many other health issues.
And we also know that people who do receive treatment and intervention, more than half of those people get that care in primary care settings.
Well, the Commonwealth report also acknowledges that without a substantive coordinated care system, behavioral health patients were more likely to fall through the cracks, more likely not to follow up with visits, not to be able to afford those visits, and also didn't receive timely referrals when they needed it. And we've learned this in our own practice, Mark. When a primary care provider can give a patient a warm handoff down the hall so they're seen immediately, that's just a huge barrier that gets removed to getting behavioral health services.
And while these practices are still relatively rare in the country, there's good news. More are on the way, and the federal government is making efforts to promote programs that better support behavioral health treatment, access, and outcomes. And we do know one thing. Once the previously uninsured population gains health coverage, they're more able to avail themselves of primary care resources, which in turn leads to better access to all types of care, including behavioral health services.
And gaining access to insurance coverage is something that our guest today knows quite a bit about. Genevieve Kenny is the co-director of the Health Policy Center at the Urban Institute. She's been analyzing the effects of gaining coverage for the poor and uninsured, both children and adults, for years, and has done some considerable work analyzing the impact of getting coverage on health outcomes, especially with the Medicaid population.
And Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policies in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Genevieve Kenny in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Drugs and their costs, the human toll and the economic one. Some 30 million Americans are grappling with diabetes, and those numbers are expected to triple within a couple of decades as the nation's population ages and the costs are notable. Cost of diabetes drugs have skyrocketed. The cost of the hormone insulin, one of the most important treatments for diabetes, rose nearly 200% between 2002 and 2013. That, according to a new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. While other diabetes medications also increased in price, total spending on insulin in 2013 was greater than the combined spending on all those other drugs. The large increase in costs largely explained by much greater use of newer types of insulin known as analog insulins, better for some patients, and much more costly than the human insulin they replaced. The price of oral diabetes drugs known as DPP-4 inhibitors increased 34% between 2006 and 2013, but some good news in the report, the cost per pill of metformin actually fell by 93% from 2002 to 2013. And the U.S. isn't the only country grappling with an opioid crisis. According to a recent report, Europeans spend about $24 billion a year on illegally obtained narcotics. The report, drawn up by Europol and the European Union Drug Monitoring Center, said new technology, encrypted networks, and digital currencies have opened up a new market for online supply of illicit drugs. Ah, the hookup generation, fueled by mobile apps such as Tinder, have turned millennials into the STD generation, apparently. According to a study done by the Rhode Island Department of Health, young adults have seen a huge spike in a whole range of STDs. Between 2013 and 2014, cases of syphilis grew by 79%. HIV infections were up 33%, and gonorrhea cases increased 30%. Rhode Island says the recent uptick in cases follows a national trend. The state's health department blamed high-risk behaviors that have become more common in recent years, using social media to arrange casual and often anonymous encounters. But Tinder isn't the only social media site that's led to a spike in STDs. According to several studies, a 2013 New York University study found Craigslist was responsible for a 16% increase in HIV cases across 33 states. The study urges clinicians and public health officials to do more to get this message out to their younger audience about their vulnerabilities. And first comes love, then comes marriage, then that baby. Not always in that order, but the old adage of the haggard, sleep-deprived mother may be a bit of an old wives' tale. According to a recent study, it seems the dads are the most sleep-deprived in those newborn days. Based on a one-off study done several years ago, 72 couples monitored during the first postpartum month used wrist trackers, and they found the fathers had objectively less sleep than the mothers. Sleep was measured throughout the day. While mothers, of course, had more feeding time in the night, they were able to play catch-up during the day when fathers were unable to do so. So, planning for baby? Dads and moms, plan ahead. There will be mind-numbing sleeplessness, but a whole lot of joy until the teenage years, that is. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Genevieve Kenny, PhD, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Health Policy Center at the Urban Institute. She's a nationally renowned expert on Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP, and broader health coverage issues facing low-income families in this country. Dr. Kenny has been conducting policy research for 25 years and has published over 160 peer-reviewed articles on insurance coverage, access to care, and outcomes for children and pregnant women. Her recent focus has shifted to the impact of the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Kenny earned her master's in statistics and her PhD in economics from the University of Michigan. Jenny, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, the Urban Institute has such deep roots, a nonpartisan DC think tank formed initially. It was kind of interesting back at the LBJ administration in 1968, so that independent economists could analyze the effectiveness of government policies launched during the so-called Great Society. That's just really marvelous that people were thinking about sort of the
outcomes
yeah. back then. And maybe you could talk to our listeners about the evolution of the Urban Institute's mission from that initial launch 50 years ago and how it's evolved to address the 21st century realities.
Well, I would say that the Urban Institute's core mission has really remained the same, and that is to bring objective evidence to bear on pressing social and economic problems and to inform policy decisions. But certainly the circumstances in which we operate have changed so that the specific research and policy questions have evolved as well. As you indicated, the Urban Institute was founded during a time of great unrest, distress in America's cities, particularly the inner cities. And over the next five decades, as our population has grown and become more heterogeneous and more complex, many of the issues once considered specific to urban America have gravitated outward to all corners of the country. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the health policy group, we have an interdisciplinary team of more than 50 researchers, and we focus on a broad range of issues affecting private and public health insurance coverage, including Medicare and Medicaid. Many of our projects today focus on the Affordable Care Act and its implications, but we also are focused on understanding other changes in health and health policy.
Well, Genevieve, this issue of the impact of insurance coverage or lack thereof is obviously something of great concern to us all. And I'm looking back to 2010, it in some ways seems a lifetime ago, with an estimated 50 million Americans with no health coverage, which meant really pretty poor access to health care. And you were able to chart the impact of lack of coverage on these populations long before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And now I think are able to chart some of the impact of having coverage since the Affordable Care Act. Share with us, what is the notable change? What are the impacts that you're seeing?
So we've been studying health insurance coverage for decades. Who has it and who doesn't? The consequence of going without coverage, since we know that having health insurance coverage does not guarantee access to care. And what we know from the decades of research evidence that has accumulated that we and others have conducted is that being uninsured puts people at much greater risk of going without or delaying care that they need, not getting immunizations and other preventive services, and of experiencing medical debt and related financial burden associated with meeting their health care costs. We also have evidence from multiple studies that Medicaid improves self-reported mental and physical health status in adults, and a really exciting emerging research base that finds reductions in mortality associated with expansions in coverage. In addition, in the 2 or 3 or 4 years following an expansion, we're also beginning to understand more about the long-term effects that health insurance can have on people's lives. In particular, there's growing evidence that the expansions of coverage to children and pregnant women that began back in the 1980s with Medicaid and that were furthered with the enactment of the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, in 1997, have had long-term effects. We're seeing evidence that they've led to a reduction in chronic health care conditions and mortality and increases in educational attainment and income later in life. So as we pivot to look at the Affordable Care Act and the impact of the coverage expansions there, we're going to have to be patient because the effects do not materialize overnight.
Dr. Kenny, the government's latest numbers show that we've covered about 20 million under the health law thus far, but many more Americans still remain uninsured. The number of states that have refused the Medicaid expansions offered by the federal government, rejecting even billions of federal dollars to expand the state-based programs so that people living close to poverty could be covered. Maybe you could talk to our listeners about those states that did not expand Medicaid, and what was the impact been to the overall population health as well as to those states' bottom line?
It was one of the primary mechanisms by which the Affordable Care Act sought to reduce uninsurance. It was targeted at non-elderly adults with incomes below 138% of the federal poverty level. So that's about $16,000 for a single adult annually, or $27,000 for a family of three. The Medicaid expansion under the ACA targeted non-elderly adults because Medicare was already in place to cover the elderly, and because Medicaid and CHIP had evolved over time to provide access to coverage for most low and poor children, and many even moderate income children. But prior to the ACA, in most states, few poor adults who were not pregnant or disabled were eligible for Medicaid, particularly if they did not have children. So few poor adults qualified for Medicaid. The uninsurance rates in this group was the highest of any group prior to the ACA. About 40% lacked coverage. But in 2012, the Supreme Court decision put the decision of whether to expand Medicaid into states' hands. And as you indicated, not all states have availed themselves of that opportunity. To date, 31 states and the District of Columbia have expanded Medicaid coverage. The 19 states that have not expanded Medicaid are concentrated in the South. Of the southern states, only Arkansas and Kentucky, and now Louisiana, that's set to expand this summer, have expanded Medicaid. First, it means that a growing share of the nation's uninsured is living in the South. We found that between 2013 and 2015, the share of uninsured adults living in the South rose from 42 to 48%. But it also has outsized impacts for African Americans who are uninsured because a disproportionate share of them live in the South. So what this means is that where you live affects whether you qualify for subsidized health insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act. And to give a perspective on how this could play out, when we looked at the uninsured and expanding states and non-expanding states in 2014, we found that just 44% of the uninsured in the states that had not expanded Medicaid were eligible for some kind of financial assistance under the ACA, and that compares to 68% in the states that had expanded Medicaid. So that's the backdrop for the question I think that you also asked, which is, what do we know about how coverage has been changing, and is we've seen different patterns in states that have expanded Medicaid versus not. Every federal and private survey that tracks coverage has found a dramatic drop in the uninsured since 2013, somewhere around a 40% decline for adults, give or take, depending on the survey. And when we look at states that have expanded versus not, we see a drop of over 50% in the uninsured rate for adults in expansion states compared to just about 25% in the non-expansion states. And we're also beginning to compile evidence on the fiscal implications of Medicaid expansion for states. Now, we have evidence from in-depth studies from Arkansas, Kentucky, and Washington, and all have found there were state fiscal gains that outweighed the increases in state costs. And that comes about for a number of reasons, including the fact that states were using state programs to provide care for some of the uninsured prior to the Affordable Care Act, particularly for mental health services and substance abuse treatment services. But it also comes about because with the Affordable Care Act, the federal government is paying a higher share of the costs for this population.
You know, Jenny, I wonder if I could ask you maybe to think a little bit as an economist and a statistician. Been thinking about Medicaid in terms of some of the things it covers that people don't usually think about in terms of support it might provide to the states. Thinking of the home visitation programs for low-income families. Some of the states have chosen to, on their own, expand coverage for high-risk groups like undocumented or non-U.S. citizens who are pregnant, and to get coverage for them, really reaching in and identifying where we have particular high-risk, high-need situations. Do you see a willingness among the Medicaid programs to expand coverage to deal with some of the really challenging problems beyond even the day-to-day medical care that people need?
Well, the way I characterize Medicaid is it's a program that's targeted at meeting the needs of often our most disadvantaged populations with disproportionately complex health care needs.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so when you look, for example, at the profile of Medicaid, historically it's been much higher than what private coverage has addressed. And I think you two are focused on the economic piece. And in the Medicaid program, there's been a history of addressing, say, transportation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many poor families don't have access to vehicles, and so transportation costs can be a barrier. So Medicaid programs have addressed that need. I think there's the longest history with children. Benefit for children in Medicaid is designed to meet not only medical needs that have been identified, but also to diagnose and screen for and treat developmental issues, cognitive issues, and other kinds of health problems before they emerge.
We're speaking today with Genevieve Kenny, PhD, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Health Policy Center at the Urban Institute. She's a nationally renowned expert on Medicaid, CHIP, and the broader health coverage issues facing low-income families in this country. Jenny, I wanted to pull the thread on the uninsured, but I want to sort of get the flip side of that population and those choosing to remain uninsured. While we've seen some great strides made in getting the minority population to embrace insurance coverage and gain coverage, and there's always a recalcitrant sector of the population. Many so-called young invincibles are likely to skip seeking health coverage, and often because they feel bulletproof, and there are economic factors as well. There are many who still find coverage unaffordable due to inadequate income and high out-of-pocket expenses, which are still impacting many in this post-ACA era. Could you talk to our listeners about this sector of the population who've not ended up with coverage for a variety of reasons?
I mean, as you indicate, the number of uninsured has dropped dramatically since 2013, but we still have close to 30 million uninsured in this country, so it's still a large number. And I think you're also absolutely right that the remaining uninsured is a mixed group of people in terms of the reasons that they're uninsured. if we look in 2015, it looks like very relatively few are uninsured by choice. The data suggests that of the remaining uninsured in 2015, about 17% said that not wanting health insurance coverage was a reason that they did not have coverage. Now, some of these people, like the immigrant groups you flagged, and poor adults living in one of the 19 states that have not expanded Medicaid, don't have an affordable health insurance option available to them. So that's clearly a true affordability issue. But others are available for subsidized marketplace coverage, but don't know that that assistance is available to them. Well, study after study finds significant knowledge gaps among the remaining uninsured, both about the subsidies that are available for coverage and the penalties that are in place for people who don't have coverage. Mm-hmm. In addition, a number of the remaining uninsured are eligible for Medicaid or CHIP but not enrolled. And so that's another distinct population with specific underlying reasons and policy responses to address.
Well, Jenny, we often talk on this show about the impact of zip codes on health. Some say a better indicator of health outcomes than almost any other single factor. And we recently had Mark Edwards on the show, the Virginia Tech engineer who uncovered the depth of the Flint, Michigan water crisis. And there's a community with high unemployment and high poverty rates, and the most vulnerable, poor women and children, seem to have perhaps been the most affected by the exposure to toxic drinking water. I wonder if you sort of reflect upon, as you conduct your research at the Health Policy Center, what other factors besides health coverage comes into play when you and your team are analyzing policy impacts on population health?
Well, when we look at population health, we certainly consider health insurance coverage and the healthcare system as determining factors. But we also recognize that a host of other factors related to where people live, where their children are in school, where they're playing, affect their health and well-being. And the kinds of other factors that we consider include housing attributes and circumstances, individual access to affordable food, safety concerns, the quality of the physical and social environments, education, housing regulations, job training, food and nutrition assistance, crime and crime prevention. So we have a number of research initiatives that draw from not just researchers in the Health Policy Center, but from experts around the organization that investigate how non-medical social factors are affecting the health of our population.
We've been speaking today with Genevieve Kenny, PhD, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Health Policy Center at the Urban Institute. You can learn more about their work by going to urban.org, and you can follow her on Twitter at KennyGM. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Conversations on healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The Affordable Care Act hasn't been a major focus of the presidential campaign thus far, but we have fact-checked several claims about it from both sides. Let's take a look at some of the top claims. Republican Ted Cruz claimed that the health care law had been a job killer and had forced millions into unemployment and part-time work. But the economy has added millions of jobs since the ACA, and fewer people are being forced to work part-time, not more. Democrats Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton traded misleading claims about Sanders' single-payer health care plan. Clinton's campaign claimed that Sanders wants to dismantle Medicare, while Sanders said he wouldn't tear up the ACA. In fact, Sanders has proposed replacing the entire current health insurance system with a single-payer system in which everyone has insurance paid through tax dollars. Republican Donald Trump claimed that health care premiums under the ACA were going up 35, 45, 55%. He was talking about proposed rate increases for 2016 for some plans on the individual market. Other plans had proposed decreases in rates or single-digit increases that didn't have to be submitted for review. A Kaiser Family Foundation analysis found an average 10.1% increase from 2015 to 2016 in individual market premiums in major cities in 49 states and Washington, D.C. That's before factoring in tax credits. In one of the Democratic presidential debates, Clinton said that the Affordable Care Act had helped more African Americans than any other group to get insurance. But the Obama administration's own figures show a larger drop in the uninsured among Latinos. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Right now, there are about 3.5 million people living in refugee camps around the world. Whether displaced by wars or natural disasters, the plight of these people is often the same, living in squalid conditions in tent cities that provide little protection from harsh elements. And these conditions pose serious threats to their health and well-being. The IKEA Foundation has taken the parent company's wildly successful do-it-yourself approach to home furnishings and applied it to the problem of inadequate housing for displaced refugees. They've created a do-it-yourself dwelling that can be shipped and assembled anywhere.
So first and foremost, there's the very well-known flat pack approach that IKEA has pioneered. Secondly, the materials and the product itself. So it's a shelter. It's not a tent.
Jonathan Spampinato is the head of communications and strategic planning at the IKEA Foundation. They're working closely with United Nations organizations working on the ground, trying to assist refugees in Somalia and other parts of the world.
We extended that to also include funding for an innovation unit within the UNHCR so they could think more long term. So providing that funding allowed them to start the refugee housing shelter, looking at how to design a better shelter.
And since on average a person is likely to spend up to 12 years in a refugee camp, these IKEA structures have some unique properties that can make the experience more bearable.
The walls and the roof are made out of a new fancy version of basically a plastic material that is much more durable but very, very lightweight and still is insulated.
The IKEA Foundation currently has prototypes being tested in various refugee camps and will scale up production once refinements are made. And, true to IKEA, the price point is going to come in under $1,000 per structure. A deliverable, affordable, do-it-yourself dwelling that can provide some sense of dignity, privacy, and protection for families who are struggling as refugees. Now that's a bright idea. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Right now, there are about 3.5 million people living in refugee camps around the world. Whether displaced by wars or natural disasters, the plight of these people is often the same, living in squalid conditions in tent cities that provide little protection from harsh elements. And these conditions pose serious threats to their health and well-being. The IKEA Foundation has taken the parent company's wildly successful do-it-yourself approach to home furnishings and applied it to the problem of inadequate housing for displaced refugees. They've created a do-it-yourself dwelling that can be shipped and assembled anywhere.
So first and foremost, there's the very well-known flat pack approach that IKEA has pioneered. Secondly, the materials and the product itself. So it's a shelter. It's not a tent.
Jonathan Spampinato is the head of communications and strategic planning at the IKEA Foundation. They're working closely with United Nations organizations working on the ground, trying to assist refugees in Somalia and other parts of the world.
We extended that to also include funding for an innovation unit within the UNHCR so they could think more long term. So providing that funding allowed them to start the refugee housing shelter, looking at how to design a better shelter.
And since on average a person is likely to spend up to 12 years in a refugee camp, these IKEA structures have some unique properties that can make the experience more bearable.
The walls and the roof are made out of a new fancy version of basically a plastic material that is much more durable but very, very lightweight and still is insulated.
The IKEA Foundation currently has prototypes being tested in various refugee camps and will scale up production once refinements are made. And, true to IKEA, the price point is going to come in under $1,000 per structure, a deliverable, affordable, do-it-yourself dwelling that can provide some sense of dignity, privacy, and protection for families who are struggling as refugees. Now that's a bright idea.